Professor Dilks, on behalf of the Collaborative Research Center, the Dynamics of Ritual, but also together with my colleagues Gita Dharampal-Frick and Michael Bergunder. Our guest tonight will be Professor Dilks. He is Franz Boas Professor of Anthropology and History. Professor has specialized in South Asian history, in historical anthropology, and British colonial history. He received his BA from Wesleyan University in 1972 and his PhD from the University of Chicago in 1981. He has also become a lot of awards. Among them, I mention only one, which will take place in the next year, Old Dominion Fellow at Princeton. To list his publications would take too much time. It would not leave any time for his lecture, so I concentrate on just the many publications. His book publications include the famous The Hollow Crown, Ethnohistory of an Indian Kingdom, which has appeared already in the second edition. The Times Literary Supplement wrote when it appeared, "This is a book, a genuinely original and outstanding contribution to Indian studies." He has also edited Colonialism and Culture, or in Hilaria Raymond's Cultural Theory at the End of the Century. His latest book is called Casts of Mind, Colonialism and the Making of Modern India, published by Princeton in 2001. This is a massively documented and brilliantly argued book. It is, Professor Dilks argues that caste is in fact neither an unchanged survival of ancient India nor a single system that reflects a core cultural value. Rather than a basic expression of Indian tradition, caste is, in his opinion, a modern phenomenon, the product of a concrete historical encounter between India and British colonial rule. Professor Dilks does not contend that caste was invented by the British, but under British domination, caste did become a single term capable of meaning and above all subsuming India's diverse forms of social identity and organization. Ritual certainly plays an eminent role in caste organization and identity, and that is why we are looking forward to listening to your lecture titled The Ethnographic State, the Ritualization of Caste in Colonial India. Professor Dilks kindly agreed to answer questions after his presentation. The discussion will be chaired by my dear colleague Gita Dharampal-Frick. Please, Professor Dilks.
I'd like to begin by thanking Professor Michels for that too generous introduction, and also to thank my immediate hosts, Professor Dharampal-Frick and Professor Bergunder, for inviting me to Heidelberg. I was lucky to have been here once before in 1992, but that was a very long time ago, and it was also in the middle of February and freezing cold, so I'm happy to be here even if the summer is cooler than it was last summer. The lecture I will give today is in response to an invitation to address the relationship between some of the work I did in the book Cast of Mind to the theme of the general project ongoing around ritual. And at the risk of repeating some parts of an argument that I've already made, I'll try to make a fairly long, ambitious statement about the idea of caste as it congealed between the late 18th and the late 19th or early 20th centuries, less in relationship to the effects that colonialism had on local society, about which I wrote in The Hollow Crown and about which I will speak tomorrow in the workshop that we're having, but more in order to make some connections between some of the figures from the late 18th century who are judged frequently as having had a very different kind of relationship to Indian culture than was the case from the late 19th century on, with precisely the efflorescence of a certain kind of ethnographic colonial imaginary that develops in the late 19th century. So it's a fairly broad sweep, and I hope that I can make some connections enough to maintain at least a coherence and your attention for the next 50 minutes or so. I'll begin with a quote from Edmund Burke, and this came from his opening address at the impeachment hearing of Warren Hastings in Parliament in 1788. He said, if it could be truly said that a great gulf is fixed between you and them, it is that gulf created by manners, opinions, and laws, eradicated in the very nature of the people and which you can never efface from them. We, if we must govern such a country, must govern them upon their own principles and maxims and not upon ours. That we must not think to force them to our narrow ideas, but extend ours to take in theirs. But in that country, the laws of religion, the laws of the land, and the laws of honor are all united and consolidated in one, and bound a man eternally to the laws of what is called his caste. In a recent book entitled Liberalism and Empire, Ibn Mehta has argued that Edmund Burke's commitment to the notion that India had an integral, discrete, and distinguished history of its own was an extension of his own deep sympathy for India's distinctness and difference, as well as its ultimate right of national self-determination. As Mehta defines it, Burke's idea of history was inextricable from the notion of tradition, invariably conjoined with the laws of society, a social order that subordinated individual will to a general good. If this was so, then Indian history for Burke was defined in relation to the geographically specific and civilizationally defined derived notions that Burke invokes when speaking of caste in the quote I just read. But this is also where history becomes different in problematic respects, both for Mehta's argument and for Burke's own rhetorical assertion of parity between Britain and India. Caste, for Burke, was the principle that bound men to the laws of land, religion, and honor, the eternal bond that I just read about. He had similar notions about the relationship between custom and history in Britain, but his delineation of the centrality of caste does not merely specify the difference of India, but also the extent to which the difference was one of kind as well as substance. While British principles could be extended to encompass the customs of India, in other words, it's clear that Burke would not have allowed the opposite to be true as well. While the British were bound by contract to preserve the customary rights of their Indian subjects, Burke held, he was also clear that they had even higher obligations. And in a room like this and from a pulpit of this kind, higher obligations seem to call me too. But I'll resist if I can. This is Burke. "We are all born in subjection," he wrote, "to one great immutable pre-existent law prior to all our devices and prior to all our contrivances." Resort here to what was basically his notion of natural law was invariably the measure and the limit for his interest in and deference to Indian tradition. And here the Enlightenment, I think, is more difficult to rescue than Uday Mehta and also Shankar Muthu in a recent book on Enlightenment and Empire, among others, had recently argued, in which the universal and the Western were seen always to be interchangeable, except they were opposed to, if tolerant of, what was particular, which is to say the non-Western. It is not that Burke could not imagine an India outside of empire, but I think it's impossible to read his speeches in their historical context without realizing the extent to which his imaginings of India were never independent of empire and the imperial relationship between Britain and India. Burke's interest in India, I hold Burke up here because he's the model of the kind of, not so much enlightenment, but the kind of 18th century figure of not just toleration, but respect for Indian culture and Indian tradition. Dirk's interest was in India, though, was always an extension of his interest in Britain, and his respect for the idea of place was always motivated by a very clear attachment to his own particular place and the perspectives it required. It is not an irony of history that Burke's great assault on Warren Hastings paved the way not for empire's dissolution, I would argue, but for its revitalization. And it is also no irony that the scandals of empire that drove Burke to expend all his hard-earned political capital in the 9 years-long battle in Parliament against Warren Hastings ended up producing an imperial order of things in which all the scandals of empire were ultimately shifted from the British nabobs to the Indian natives. Anyway, that's what I'm going to go on and try to show today. For in a peculiar sense, Burke was ahead of his time, not just in his rhetorical respect for aspects of India, but also for his placement of caste at a central point as a kind of theory of political justification that could be taken, rather, to become a theory of political justification for imperial rule. Despite Burke's deep knowledge of the problems of company rule in India, and he was impressive indeed in the details that he brought to bear in the impeachment hearings, he would perhaps have been surprised and instructed by a history of India written by Ghulam Hussein during the last years of Hastings' rule. Ghulam Hussein, whose years were 1727 to 1806, hailed from a family of high-level Mughal officials, and moved in the early 1760s to Bengal to seek service under Mir Jafar, unsuccessfully, as it turned out, though he later got a job with the company. Not one he wanted, but a job nevertheless. He wrote a wonderful history, which some of you I'm sure have read, entitled, and I mispronounced this, the Sair Mutakarin, and published in 1781. Well, reflecting, and it covers the history of the Mughal Empire from its earliest days, really, up to the present day. While reflecting the declining fortunes of his own family, he provided an extraordinarily detailed and insightful commentary on the nature of British rule, and though deeply concerned about the corruption of company servants, he was most distressed about the unfriendliness, inaccessibility, and ignorance of the British. He wrote that, and I quote from the a translation done by a local chap who called himself Notus Magnum, and who is an interesting figure in his own right, but about that later, perhaps. He wrote that, as the gates of communication and intercourse are shut up betwixt the men of this land and those strangers who have become their masters, and these latter can constantly express an aversion to the society of Indians and a disdain against conversing with them, hence both parties remain ignorant of each other's state and circumstance. As a result, he wrote, and I quote again, no love and no coalition can take root between the conquerors and the conquered. Additionally, he wrote that the British understood little of the country they ruled. Hence, I quote again, they know nothing of either the reason or intent of them, but by the absurd report of their own servants, who, being all beardless and unexperienced, have no view but that of their own benefit, and think only of pleasing their English masters. Beardless and unexperienced, there I am. Ghulam Hussein, it's a wonderful, wonderful book for all sorts of reasons. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, please do. Ghulam Hussein diagnosed the main problem, therefore, as having to do with the fact that the British did not conquer India with any intention of actually settling there and residing there in some kind of serious way. With only a few exceptions, and Warren Hastings was one of them for him, the British did not learn the local language and were decidedly ignorant of native life, custom, and opinion. They did not stay in their post long enough to learn anything about local society, and because they only wished to collect as much personal fortune as possible to return to England as a newly brought member of the gentry, they had no wish to go too deeply in any of the problems that existed in India. Now, in this, he argued, the British were very different from the Mughals before them, who had come to India as conquerors, but also to stay. I quote, there were others that thought in a quite different manner, and these intending to settle forever and to fix the foot of residence and permanency in these countries, had a mind of turning their conquest into a patrimony for themselves and making it their property and their inheritance. These bent the whole strength of their genius in securing the happiness of their new subjects, nor did they ever abate anything from their efforts until they had intermarried with the natives and got children and families from them and had become naturalized. Their immediate successors, having learned the language of the country, behaved to its inhabitants as brothers of one mother and one language. Ghulam Hussein also noted that despite the major differences in custom and belief between Hindus and Muslims, the two nations had overcome their initial aversion, and over time became as one. He wrote, "The two nations have come to call us together into one whole, like milk and sugar. They have received a simmering." This is interesting to read in a number of different respects, not least, of course, because the effort to characterize the British Empire as another kind of imperial force from the outside runs afoul, I think, of a contemporaneous analysis that deserves serious reading. Now back to Burke just for a second. To be sure, Burke had argued for cultural and political respect, but I don't think he could imagine the British settling down in India any more than he could himself see his primary concern, rid himself of his primary concern for Britain and Britain's ancient constitution when thinking of the scandals of the East, which motivated his decade-long struggle against Hastings. Burke had shown how to get the attention of the British public for imperial concerns in India, but once he had rid India of the scourge of the Nabobs after the conclusion of the impeachment trial, although he might have considered it a failure because he didn't indict Hastings, at some level he's been seen as having changed the nature of the whole imperial regime. It took Cornwallis, it took the permanent settlement, and so on and so forth, to fulfill Burke's mandate, but it's in some sense Burke's inheritance that lives on in the sort of ideological sense and presentation of the empire from the late 18th century on. But our argument here is that in a peculiar sense, the association of India with scandal and the rhetorical energy that Burke expended to do that got displaced almost immediately by a different kind of scandal and a different kind of association. By the late 18th century, empire was no longer drenched in the idea of European scandal. The Nabobs had been consigned to a distant history. And instead, and increasingly, Indian tradition became the site of scandal for European representation. And by the early 19th century, the notion of a civilizing mission began to be articulated in relationship to such backward traditions as sati, pagi, ritual practices of mortification and torture, human sacrifice, among others. Now, this transformation did not happen immediately, and I'm not actually blaming Burke for it. I have no interest in assigning culpability. I'm talking about a kind of structural transformation. Nor was its outcome necessarily prefigured by the history of early imperialism. The utilitarian reformers who were cultivated by Wellesley and came to dominate the imperial establishment in the first few decades of the new century were not responsible for the elevation of custom as both the mission of and justification for the colonial state. Indeed, many of the young reformers who spent their full careers in the East, Monroe, Malcolm, Elphinstone, among others, lived and worked with Burke's zeal, sincerely believing that empire was a noble enterprise and a temporary one at that. However, the general tone of praise for Indian culture that had been adopted by many of the 18th century colonizers gradually, but almost inevitably, began to give way to the horrified description of rituals of barbarism that were used to convey the civilizational corruption and scandal that was seen as endemic to the East. While the changed tone of cultural rhetoric was driven principally by the new crusading evangelicals led by Charles Rance and William Wilberforce, these new cultural preoccupations also served to fill a gap that was left in the wake of Burke's cleansing of imperial excess. While once scandal referred to the activities of the colonizers, scandal now, in other words, began to refer to the lives of the colonized. Tipu Sultan had been vilified in the British imaginary by Wellesley and his associates, in large part to vindicate a military campaign that was costly, dangerous, and opposed by the Board of Control in London. Wellesley's military secretary, Colonel William Kirkpatrick, member of the Mysore Commission, wrote that Tipu Sultan was, I quote, "the intolerant bigot or furious fanatic, the oppressive and unjust ruler, the harsh and rigid master, the sanguinary tyrant." And Mark Wilkes, who Wellesley installed as the British resident of Mysore in 1803, wrote that Tipu Sultan had perpetually in his tongue the projects of jihad and holy war, in language that I read because it's not dissimilar from the kind of language that the government leaders of my country have used to vilify Saddam Hussein. But in the 1790s and even the climactic fall of Tipu Sultan, barbarism, in a sense, was still associated primarily with political regimes and individuals rather than cultural practices across the board. That changes, of course. And it changes in large part because of the work of the of people like Charles Grant, who was a very important figure, of course, in the early company, and Wilberforce, who was at work at home. And they themselves both promulgated and made possible the entry, of course, as is well known, of Protestant missionary activity within British India, having made the case around the charter renewal of 1813. Now, importantly here for the story of caste, it was, of course, Protestant missionaries who mounted the first systematic critique and were of caste and who were most concerned with caste and elevated it to a kind of primary place in the whole lexicon of civilizational science. And by caste, of course, embedded in particular were the Brahmin priests, the idea of the priesthood in a kind of reproduction in some sense of a Reformation language of condemnation for any kind of ritual hierarchy. Missionaries, of course, followed Grant's lead in dramatizing the importance of customs or rituals that could make the case for their own importance, and well, in their own correspondence, particularly the correspondence back to their home congregations, where they explained why it was that the harvest in souls was not what they had promised it would be, spent a great deal of time talking about the problem of caste. There was a need to, in some sense, find a cover for their own failure, and the cover, of course, came in the dramatic spectacle first of Sati, and then of Tagi. And those of course, were primary sites, in some sense, of a certain kind of public colonial attention in the early years of the 19th century that worked all kinds of wonders for a variety of different purposes. Of course, the Missionary Register, which began to publish in January of 1813, in large part to make the case for the entry of missionaries into British India around the charter renewal, was a critical player in this, excerpting, as Latha Mani has shown in her book, the most dramatic kinds of reports of Sati and statements about Sati in order to put pressure on Parliament to finally change what had been a two-century-long tradition of keeping missionaries out. Even so, of course, the government in India itself was reluctant to respond to the pressure that had been mounting since at least 1820, and it was not until 1829 that Sati was, of course, abolished. No sooner was it abolished, however, and there was a certain degree of concern about how local opinion would react, than it was joined by an even more convenient sign, and that was the sign of Tagi. Captain William Henry Sloman, of course, who served as the chief agent under Bentinck, made his career by sensationalizing his campaign against the thugs, popularly the notion, of course, that the bands of ritual murderers roamed the Indian countryside committing terrorist crimes in the name of Hindu goddesses. He first alerted the British public to the barbarism of Tagi in an anonymously authored article published in the Calcutta Literary Gazette in October 1830. And in that article asserted that Kali shrines across India accepted the offerings of ritual murderers as holy gifts, as prasad, to the as offerings, rather, to the goddess. But most gripping in the description that he makes and in the circulation of the stories that, of course, follow the same kind of trajectory as the Missionary Register in its writings about Sati, was the attribution of a system of murder, in this case, to religious ritual sanction and organization. Efforts in generating support were, of course, successful. Certainly, they were successful for his own career. And indeed, his work alone provided ample justification in parts of British India for the investment of greater resources into an aggressive police force, as well as continuation of expansionist military policies. His writings, of course, at the same time confirmed to a broad public in Britain that he liberalism was the cause of India's scandals and Britain a force of rule for good in the triumph over evil. Problem, of course, as I'm sure many of you know, that the various groups labeled as thugs were highly miscellaneous, including itinerant mendicants, insurgent soldiers, disbanded from service by chiefs who had either been conquered or at least converted into landlords, migrant labor, as well as other gypsy-like groups, such as the Banjaras, for example, who stayed constantly on the move, included Muslim and Hindu peoples, as well as, of course, anyone who was itinerant, because if you weren't settled, the colonial state found you a very difficult person to police, control, and tax. Radhika Sinha, in a recent book, has suggested that Thuggee was extraordinarily diverse and unstructured in its origins and activities, inasmuch as it can be named at all, many times reflecting nothing more than an underground economy of poverty and desperation, connected in many instances with the dislocations rendered by colonial conquest and rule. British concern about the lack of safety and stability on the roads of the subcontinent was not unrelated, of course, to the expansion of its country trade to the interior of India, and in particular to the transport of opium to Calcutta for its use in the China tea trade. What gave the classificatory rubric of Thuggee its reign and its power to displace possible concerns on the part of similar constituencies to the transport and use of opium, of course, was the linking of a social imaginary of mystery and fear around a religious cult committed to murder. After all, J.W.K. was quite proud when he wrote in his History of the East India Company, a few Englishmen, he wrote, had purged India of this great pollution. Now, 1857, of course, changes all of this and becomes the moment of crisis, as it were, for the missionary project. But it also becomes the moment, I argue in my book, where in some sense the missionary mandate gets taken over by the colonial state. And by the same token, and according to a logic that had already been unfolding, it was also the case that the state picked up the primary concern that missionaries had had about caste and in some sense used it as the kind of linchpin and raison d'etre that connected a whole variety of new colonial mandates and institutional projects. Caste, of course, ceased to be an institution that was to be overcome in order to convert souls. It became instead the colonial version of civil society that could be ruled through caste at the same time it was to be ruled in some sense because of caste. Social reform gave way to, even within a missionary discourse of reform that gets, of course, picked up and appropriated in various kinds of interesting ways by reformist movements, including by Phule in Maharashtra, by reformers of up to present day Dalit groups. But it gets overtaken and transmitted into a kind of concern for the colonial state in the late 19th century, having to do, of course, not with social reform, but social regulation. So, again, moving along as quickly as I can, 1857 was the peculiar pretext for the conversion of religious difference into an argument about political indifference or social indifference, even as it served to warn against religious interference and cultural ignorance. When Queen Victoria put a halt in 1858 to the evangelical mission of empire, she nevertheless gave voice to a growing concern among many Britons that Christianity was a mark of their own difference from and superiority to Indian subjects, a very different state of affairs. But in this, missionary failure could be converted into strength. The difficulties of conversion blamed on the intransigent alterity of caste. The most common general explanation for the Great Revolt, of course, was precisely caste. In an essay written in April of 1858, Max Müller took up the question of the true meaning of caste in India, and it's quite interesting that his one major article on caste was written and published in 1858. And he wrote that, and I quote, "Among the causes assigned for the Sepoy Mutiny, caste has been made the most prominent. By one party it is said that too much, by another that too little regard was paid to caste." Müller, of course, was right that the revolt occasioned an extraordinary proliferation of writing on the subject of caste, some of it by missionaries who thought that the time had come for an intensified assault on caste by the government, which would declare caste as the central enemy of empire, according to a lot of stuff that was written in the years immediately after the Great Rebellion. And indeed, missionaries had worried about this for a long time, but saw 1857-58 as a potential pretext for sort of moving in, only to find, of course, that they were moved out. Miller himself had a view that was somewhat different than the normal missionary view about caste, in which caste had become seen as essentially a religious institution and not a mere civil institution. And the division between what is religious and what is civil got invoked in large part because of the notion that if you're going to convert, you have to be able to convert only in a domain of religion, which doesn't affect the social, even though, of course, the worry was constantly that the two were being conflated by the mischievous priesthood that used its social power to legislate religious conviction. But Miller, of course, had a much more nuanced view, although one that was interesting and peculiar for its own reasons as well, believing that most explanations of the nature and meaning of caste misconstrue both the relationship between religious and social domains, and of course the extent, and here he speaks as an Orientalist, to which modern manifestations of popular religion deviated from the original and pure classical Hinduism. He held that none of the objectionable traces of caste could be found in the original constitution of Hindu thought, in language that could later have been used, and indeed in many respects was later used by writers as various as Gandhi himself in recharacterizing and reconceptualizing Varnashrama Dharma. Miller announced that, and I quote again from his essay, the government would be perfectly justified in declaring it would no longer consider caste as part of the religious system of the Hindus. Caste, in the modern sense of the word, is no religious institution. It has no authority in the sacred writings of the Brahmins, and by whatever promise the government may have bound itself to respect the religion of the natives, referring, of course, to the proclamation, that promise will not be violated even though penalties were inflicted for the observance of rules of caste. Ironically, therefore, Miller ultimately argued that caste could not be abolished in India, and indeed that any effort to do so would be one of the most hazardous operations that was ever performed on a living social body. Now, by 1858, Miller was one of the last Orientalists who, in some sense, was out there defending Indian civilization in these kinds of public writings. He wasn't the last Orientalist by any means, but he was making these kinds of statements that had been made by previous generations and was about to be eclipsed by a new kind of characterization of the relationship between the civilizational past and the cultural present. And he even at some point actually argued in a peculiar about-face that caste would become the engine for the conversion of whole classes of Indian society. But he increasingly was drowned out by a new kind of language of Christian triumphalism that gave up both the missionary project as a kind of needed legitimation of the colonial state project, and the idea, in some sense, that the change was a possible thing at all, that conversion, whether to Christianity or to modernity, was something to which the West should aspire. So let me then move on to what overtakes that earlier kind of characterization of civilization, and move to a notion of culture that begins increasingly to take its place. Now, the anthropologization, what I call the anthropologization of colonial knowledge, proceeded slowly, and in the context, of course, of more and other interests and processes in the period. However, it is certainly no accident that the decade of the 1860s saw a veritable explosion in the production and circulation of gazetteers and manuals that now included, as a matter of course, extensive reports on the manners and customs of castes, tribes, and religions. Much official ethnography later reported in manuals and then in ethnological catalogs when it didn't directly come from early missionary castes, and of course often it did, began to become increasingly scripted in the administrative military and policing files and accompanying reports that had to do with the concerns of the colonial state in the late 19th century. And in particular emerged around the colonial state's need to follow the proclamation of Queen Victoria in the sense of non-interference. So the question is, you have to be able to, if you interfere in an issue that raises questions, say, of public order, you have to be able to say that you're not interfering in something that has to do with the real religion of India. Missionaries continued at this time to play an important role off stage, generating sufficient publicity for successive crises to develop around the question of what the colonial state could countenance. But the policy of non-interference required increasingly a set of discriminations, a set of judgments. And I wrote about this, for example, in the book, where I talk about the problem of hook swinging, which had been a problem that was of successive interest every 20, 30 years or so. There was a kind of cyclic emergence of concern about hook swinging and the need of for the British state to, of course, to abolish it. Only to find, of course, that you know there were lots of justifications for it that seemed to be plausible and seemed to require the proclamation of non-interference to keep abolition from taking place. Ultimately, when hook swinging got abolished in Madras, it was because of an injury that was incurred by somebody who was being swung, not because it was in fact deemed to be a religious problem. But nevertheless, a great deal of effort went into the compilation of a kind of archive of religious justification and textual justification for why hook swinging, in fact, was an accretion of a non-Brahmanic and therefore non-Hindu kind, and those equations are made quite literally, rather than something fundamental to the Hindu religion, and therefore something that could be interfered with. Although, of course, the colonial state was always worried when it had the license to do so. Now, as is well known, and I'll move now to the last sort of part of the talk, the explosion, in some sense, of a kind of new ethnographic interest through the manuals and gazetteers of the 1860s, 70s, and 80s becomes something much more important and altogether more powerful in the hands, first of the decennial census, and then, of course, in the hands of H.H. Wisley when he moves from having been the commissioner of the Bengal census in 1891 to being the commissioner for the All India census in 1901. Wisley had begun his work on caste in Bengal, of course, by noting, among many other things, and I quote, that race sentiment, so far from being a figment of the intolerant pride of the Brahmin, rests upon a foundation of fact which scientific methods confirm, that it has shaped the intricate groupings of the caste system, and has preserved the Aryan type in comparative purity throughout northern India. Caste may have been justified as a subject of study increasingly because it was seen by many who were organizing administrative matters from famine relief to criminality. But in the same breath as Wisley invoked all of those rationales for installing caste as the primary object, in some sense, of administrative inquiry in the census of 1901, first in 1891 and then in 1901, he also constituted, in a peculiar sense, a grammatical ritual system in which the most esoteric forms of social distinction became regarded as the proper domain of administrative knowledge as well as scientific inquiry. Now, in the justification for the ethnographic survey of that was part of the 1901 census, the Secretary of State of India wrote in a minute that actually was published in the very first edition of the journal Man, that the systematic description of the history, structure, traditions, and religious and social usages of the various races, tribes, and castes in India, along with an anthropometric survey, which would measure the castes according to their physical types, were absolutely central to the project of the colonial state. As he wrote further, and I quote, "It has come to be recognized of late years that India is a vast storehouse of social and physical data which only need to be recorded in order to contribute to the solution of the problems which are being approached in Europe with the aid of material, much of which is inferior in quality. It is unnecessary to dwell at length upon the obvious advantages to many branches of the administration in this country of an accurate and well-arranged record of the customs and the domestic and social relations of the various castes and tribes. The entire framework of native life in India is made up of groups of this kind, and the status and conduct of individuals are largely determined by the roles of the group to which they belong. For the purposes of legislation, of judicial procedure, of family relief, of sanitation, of an ethnographic survey of India, and a record, the dealings with epidemic disease, and almost every other form of executive action, for all these reasons, an ethnographic survey of India and a record of the customs of the people is as necessary an incident of good administration as a cadastral survey of the land and a record of the rights of its tenants. It's a famous quote, and I'm sure you've heard it before, but it records perhaps more efficiently than any other the appropriation of a certain kind of anthropological interest by the colonial administrative apparatus in the early 20th century. Now, Whitley innovated on this theme in a number of different ways, of course, and in particular, he had this racial obsession in which he divided his population up into seven different subcategories of racial groups that he had perfectly orthogonal and independent and autonomous from each other. But he also insisted upon the principle of social precedence, and he used for that what he called native public opinion to serve as the basic measure for hierarchy. He was convinced that distinctions predicated on the centrality of Brahmins and involving matters of rank on the basis of ritual distinction would be far more helpful in understanding the nature of the caste system as a whole than theories about occupation, of course, his rivalry with Crook is well known, or a variety of other evolutionary theories that were regnant among some groups of ethnologists at the time. He prepared criteria for understanding caste distinctions that could have, and indeed probably have, served as research guidelines for latter-day students of cultural anthropology. I'll quote, that Brahmins will take water from certain castes, that Brahmins of high standing will serve particular castes, that certain castes, though not served by the best Brahmins, have not nevertheless got Brahmins of their own, whose rank varies according to circumstance, that certain castes are not served by Brahmins at all, but have priests of their own, that the status of certain castes has been raised by their taking to infant marriage or abandoning the remarriage of widows, and that the status of some castes has been lowered by their living in a particular locality, that the status of others has been modified by their pursuing some occupation in a special or peculiar way, that some can claim the services of the village barber, the village palanquin barber, the village midwife, etc., while others cannot, and so on and so forth. In a litany that, of course, in many ways provides a kind of charter for a certain kind of ethnographic interest in local caste relations and social life in Indian villages that continued to the time when I went to graduate school now some years ago, but nevertheless was alive and well in almost that same language. And this is the language that's inaugurated in the census, in the census materials of 1901. I will hardly remind you, going back to the turn of the century, or the turn of the previous century, that Risley was this deeply invested in the minutia of caste status to the point of, in fact, because of his deference to a certain sense of the local and local culture for the purposes that he had in mind, to the point of actually certifying practices and often legitimating practices such as infant marriage, the prohibition of widow remarriage, or even untouchability, at a time, of course, of active social reform. So this was not a neutral document, nor was it a neutral interest. And it had a very specific location, I think, within the colonial apparatus of the time, and a very critical time at that. Risley returned in his writings to the use of the idea of varna as the basis for enumeration and classification, as befitted both his resort to Brahmanical opinion and his interest in social rank. And he clearly believed the present-day castes will be known representatives of one or other of the castes of the theoretical Hindu system. That's his language. Accordingly, and I quote from him again, in every scheme of grouping, the Brahmin heads the list. Then come the castes whom popular opinion accepts as the modern representatives of the Kshatriyas, and those who have followed, and so on and so forth. And that's the usual language. Now, Vyasind of, I'm sorry, and for him, the degree to which Ireland love was retained by a group was marked by the direction in which women were exchanged hyperbolously or endogamously, and by exchanges of food, wear, and services between castes. And so for him, even the categories that he used all the way up and all the way down, in some sense of his census survey, invoked these, obviously contested notions within the emergent reformist movements of South Asia. He wrote that that Varna was important even for non-Hindus. For in India, he wrote, "Caste is in the air. Its contagion has spread even to the Mohammedans, and they found its evolution proceeding on characteristically Hindu lines." Now, in contemplating the extent to which caste might be breaking down as a consequence of new ideas and institutions, as well as the kinds of effects that the railways and the occupations, urbanization, and so on were having, Wesley observed that, in fact, in a counterintuitive result of this, what was happening was a more rigid observance of the essential incidence of caste. And in some ways, of course, at least speaking and referring to a particular segment of the population, he was right. There were all sorts of rigidifications, but of course, he didn't reflect upon his own role, or rather the role of the state, and in some sense sanctioning that very rigidification and re-invocation of a certain set of logics that might have otherwise had a more contestatory life in local politics and certainly in sort of urban social life. Now, the ultimate proof for Wesley of the wisdom of his system was the great number of petitions and memorials to which it gave rise. Census officers had received similar petitions and representations since the first census, but the announcement by Wesley that the census would be reorganized on the basis of social precedents made it into a political instrument in a way that it had never been before. He asserted that these efforts vindicated his belief that the sole test of social precedents was native public opinion. But, of course, and this was something that Bernard Cohen, in his great essay on the census of 1969, used to sort of demonstrate the way in which the census began to produce new kinds of movements, new kinds of associations, and a whole set of engagements, in some sense, with the legislations of the colonial state, was over precisely the kind of apparent transparency of the system of precedents, but the importance that was accorded to it within the official register of the enumerative census. Now, the report, of course, of the 1901 census that Wesley scripted was republished in its entirety, almost without revision, as the book The People of India that was published in 1908. There was one revision, however, and that was the addition of a single concluding chapter, which was entitled Caste and Nationality. In this final chapter of the book, Wesley sought to address the effects of recent social and economic change on caste, as well as to speculate about whether caste would be favorable or adverse to the growth of a consciousness of a common nationality among the people of India. Perhaps, of course, in response to the clear indications of a developing nationalist movement that had erupted in Bengal after 1905, after the partition, and Wesley was very much involved in the partition, and I'll say a bit about that in just a second. But he wrote in his chapter on nationality that anarchy is the peculiar peril of a society that is organized on the basis of caste, noting that ancient Indian monarchy had functioned well precisely because it could control caste antipathies. But for the same reason, caste hardly contributed to the formation of an idea of common nationality. So now he wrote, as a regime of caste persists, it is difficult to see how the sentiment of unity and solidarity can penetrate and inspire all classes of the community from the highest to the lowest. Now, Wesley's final contribution, in some sense, to colonial knowledge, here reiterated the divisiveness of caste, of course, as well as its fundamental compatibility with the colonial politics. Politics, in other words, only in two registers, one of ancient Indian monarchy and the other of modern Britain's benevolent despotism. He warned Indian nationalists and European liberals alike not to give in either to impatient idealism or a belief in the force of modern change in India. For caste was the basic obstacle, and he wrote, and I quote, where its cohesive power withdrawn, or its essential ties relaxed, it is difficult to form an idea of the probable consequences. Such a change would be like a revolution. It would resemble the withdrawal of some elemental force like gravitation or molecular attraction. Order would vanish, and chaos would supervene. Strong language for the early 20th century. And he did not mention that this revolution would be pitted against British rule in India, only noting that the kind of revolution envisioned by Indian nationalists would be in the order of a national disaster. So to repeat, at a time of resounding efforts to engage in social reform and anti-Brahminical privilege, Risley directed the full apparatus of colonial power to the task of using India to prove the truth of racial difference and social hierarchy, sacerdotal hierarchy, ritual hierarchy. In his enterprise, he accepted Brahmin claims about the superiority of such customs as the prohibition of literary marriage or the importance of infant marriage, even as he rejected the claims of manifestly non-Aryan racial groups to twice-born status in a kind of reification process of this all. One imagines in some way that Risley would have set himself up as an ancient Indian monarch if only he could, adjudicating competing claims over status with Kalapurs and Mohan, with Kalapurs in one hand and his statistical tables about nasal indices in the other. And in his last work on caste, he effectively denied the capacity of Indians for the formation of an idea of nationality, let alone self-rule. At a time of nationalist mobilization, this is obviously a problem. But, as I say, the real problem was that Risley was, in some sense, inaugurating a process of legitimation for precisely not just the kinds of movements that were generated to oppose nationalism, but also for the kinds of anti-Brahmin movements that were themselves becoming very important throughout much of India at the time. Now, in addition to this, he was at the time the Home Secretary to the Indian government, a position he assumed after his stint as Director of Ethnography. He actually played a very key role in the 1903 proposal that Bengal be partitioned into two provinces, in large part because of the political benefits thought to attend to the separation of the politically threatening Hindu minority from the majority Hindu population. And a few years later, Risley argued very strongly against the view of John Morley, who was the Secretary of State for India, that serious political reforms were necessary in the wake of the agitation over the 1905 partition. Risley was against territorial representation in parliamentary government for India, of course, but he used the demand of the newly formed Muslim League for separate electorates to make his case. And in the end, the amount of separate electorates for Muslims in the Mitter reforms of 1909 was in large part the result of the energetic role played by Risley behind the scenes, who used his ethnological authority to make one of the most influential and, of course, in the end, deeply problematic decisions of Britain's colonial era. It was this award of separate electorates, of course, that set up the conditions of possibility for the partition of India altogether. So, in taking this broad sweep of history and risking repeating things that I've written before in the book, I'm obviously attributing here a great deal of power to the colonial state. And I'm suggesting that empire mattered and that it had profound effects as much on social and cultural life as in political and economic domains. Now, I just want to end my talk with a few caveats and a few implications. The emphasis in this project on colonialism is not meant to do a number of things. First of all, it's not meant to suggest that India was just this pliant field on which colonial agency played itself out. And if I were to give the other half of this talk, I would try to show that it's precisely, in some sense, at the points of resistance that one sees both, in some sense, the most troubling effects that colonialism had, but also the kind of movements that constantly sought to escape the hold that colonialism had over the kind of cultural repertoire and social modality of a whole variety of political and social movements. At the same time, my emphasis here is not meant to try to either flatten or make irrelevant all pre-colonial history, nor for that matter to imply that the post-colonial condition is a direct byproduct of British intentionality. Far from it. My approach also to the history of caste is not, and I was glad this was said in the introduction, is not meant to assert that the British themselves invented caste, thus depriving Indians of agency, or willfully wishing away the profound role that multiple regimes and histories of caste had played in the past. I would hope, certainly, that this that the work I've done in association with caste of mind would be read in conjunction with the earlier work of the Hollow Crown on the social history of politics, the cultural history of history, and the political history of social relations in pre-colonial southern India. From there, I attempted to illustrate the proposition that what we now take to be caste is in fact the precipitate of a complicated history that selected caste in the end as the single, systematic, culturally essential, and religiously sanctioned category to name and contain the entire Indian social order. I have indeed tried to show how caste was in, say, 18th century Pitagupta, just to take a name out of the hat and a place out of the hat, was situated in a much larger social field of territorial lineages and cohorts, and lineage segments and other kinds of groupings, of family units, occupational groups, royal retinues, royal relations of service and the like, merchant communities, warrior clans, dependent serfs, domestic slaves, as well as groups constituted through relations of worship, endowment, employment, or pilgrimage. But indeed, the idea of a single, uniform, and all-embracing autonomy of endogamous caste groupings ordered solely by the principles of sacerdotal or scriptural hierarchy awaited, in some sense, the entry of somebody like H.H. Risley. The end story, the kind of ethnographic irony at the end, in some sense, that the story that we've been told about caste to a very large extent is implicated deeply in colonial history, is something that, in some sense, only can be seen as counterintuitive in relationship to an ethno-historical set of inquiries that many of you here have engaged in on the kingdoms and chiefdoms and political logics and processes of pre-colonial India. And that, of course, is what inserts the baseline, in some sense, for any kind of study of the social effects of colonialism. And the history heard by certain groups, many of them, in this case, Brahmin and upper caste, obtained new forms of administrative power and came to occupy positions where they could help write gazetteers, devise census questionnaires, adjudicate colonial policies concerning religious interference and autonomy, and ultimately guide administrative decisions around issues ranging from crowd control during festivals to problems of famine, epidemic, to marital rights, temple management, and municipal service. This is complicated as the complicities were structural rather than agentive. But the structures were colonial structures, and these structures were shaped by the ideas of caste and ritual that were so predominant, and as I've tried to show here, in some sense were there even from the days of the benevolent Edmund Burke. Even though the politics of writing about colonialism in India has changed constantly in some sense, it changed after Mumbai, and now it's changed after the election, the growing disavowal on the other side, as it were, of the importance of empire, from the writings of the Oxford History of the British Empire to recent books by scholars such as David Cannadine and Neil Ferguson, seems as historically wrong as it is wrong in suggesting that imperial ambition is not still, and I now obviously speak to the present, is not still alive and well. Unfortunately, not only is this manifestly so, it is so in large part because of the same kinds of ways in which the ideas of cultural difference that I've adumbrated here have been politicized and adapted to a colonial interest rather than the kind of interest that Burke would have had in mind when he talked about cultural respect. Thank you for your attention and your patience.